My turn. Though she was half kidding, I could see that she was a little nervous. I repeated the same instructions as before and hit 30 more balls without comment. This time, there were frowns appearing on the women's faces, and their footwork seemed a little more awkward than before. After the 30th ball, there were 8 balls at the net, and the balls behind me were quite scattered. Inwardly, I criticized myself for having spoiled the magic. Then Claire, the girl who had originally asked me about positive thinking, exclaimed, "Oh, I ruined it for everyone. I was the first to hit a ball into the net, and I hit 4 of them." I was amazed, as were the others, because it wasn't true. It was another person who had netted the first ball, and Claire had hit only 2 balls into the net. Her judgmental mind had distorted her perception of what had actually happened. Then I asked the women if they were aware of something different going through their minds during the second series of balls. Each of them reported being less aware of their feet and more intent on trying to keep from hitting balls into the net. They were trying to live up to an expectation, a standard of right and wrong, which they felt had been set before them. This was exactly what had been missing during the first set of balls. I began to see that my compliment had engaged their judgmental minds. Self-one, the ego mind, had gotten into the act. Through this experience, I began to see how self-one operated. Always looking for approval and wanting to avoid disapproval, this subtle ego mind sees a compliment as a potential criticism. It reasons, if the pro is pleased with one kind of performance, he will be displeased by the opposite. If he likes me for doing well, he will dislike me for not doing well. The standard of good and bad had been established, and the inevitable result was divided concentration and ego interference. The women also began to realize the cause of their tightness on the third round of balls. Then Claire seemed to light up like a 1,000-watt bulb. "Oh, I see," she exclaimed, slapping her hand to her forehead. "My compliments are criticisms in disguise. I use both to manipulate behavior." Whereupon she ran off the court saying that she had to find her husband. Evidently, she had seen connection between how she treated herself on the tennis court and her family relationships, for an hour later, I saw her with her husband, still absorbed in intense conversation. Clearly, positive and negative evaluations are relative to each other. It is impossible to judge one event as positive without seeing other events as not positive or as negative. There is no way to stop just the negative side of the judgmental process. To see your strokes as they are, there is no need to attribute goodness or badness to them. The same goes for the results of your strokes. You can notice exactly how far out a ball lands without labeling it a bad event. By ending judgment, you do not avoid seeing what is. Ending judgment means you neither add nor subtract from the facts before your eyes. Things appear as they are, undistorted. In this way, the mind becomes more calm. "But," protests self-one, "if I see my ball going out and I don't evaluate it as bad, I won't have any incentive to change it. If I don't dislike what I'm doing wrong, how am I going to change it?" Self-one, the ego mind, wants to take responsibility for making things better. It wants the credit for playing an important role in things. It also worries and suffers a lot when things don't go its way. The following chapter will deal with an alternative process, a process by which actions flow spontaneously and sensibly without an ego mind on the scene chasing positives and trying to reform negatives. But before concluding this chapter, read this profound but deceptively simple story told me by a much-respected friend of mine named Bill. 3 men in a car are driving down a city street early one morning. For the sake of analogy, suppose that each man represents a different kind of tennis player. The man sitting on the right is a positive thinker who believes that his game is great and is full of self-esteem because his tennis is so superior. He's also a self-admitted playboy who enjoys all the pleasures life has to offer. The man sitting in the middle is a negative thinker who is constantly analyzing what is wrong with himself and the world. He is always involved in some kind of self-improvement program. The third man, who is driving, is in the process of letting go of judgmental thinking altogether. He plays the inner game, enjoying things as they are and doing what seems sensible. The car pulls up at a stoplight, and crossing the street in front of the car is a beautiful young lady who catches the attention of all three men. Her beauty is particularly apparent as she is stark naked. The man on the right becomes engrossed in thoughts of how nice it would be to be with this lady under other circumstances. His mind races through past memories and future fantasies of sensual pleasures. The man sitting in the middle is seeing an example of modern decadence. He's not sure that he should be looking closely at the girl. First miniskirts, he thinks, then topless dancers, then bottomless dancers. And now they're out on the streets in broad daylight. Something must be done to stop all this. The driver is seeing the same girl that the others are observing, but is simply watching what is before his eyes. He sees neither good nor bad, and as a result, a detail comes to his attention which was not noticed by either of his companions. The girl's eyes are shut. He realizes that the lady is sleepwalking. Responding immediately with common sense, he asks the person next to him to take the wheel, steps out of the car, and puts his overcoat over the woman's shoulders. He gently wakes her and explains to her that she must have been sleepwalking and offers to take her home. My friend Bill used to end the story with a twinkle in his eye saying, "There he received the rewards of his action," leaving each listener to hear what he would. The first inner skill to be developed in the inner game is that of non-judgmental awareness. When we unlearn judgment, we discover, usually with some surprise, that we don't need the motivation of a reformer to change our bad habits. We may simply need to be more aware. There is a more natural process of learning and performing waiting to be discovered. It is waiting to show what it can do when allowed to operate without interference from the conscious strivings of the judgmental self. The discovery and reliance upon this process is the subject of the next chapter. But first, one balancing thought. It is important to remember that not all remarks are judgmental. Acknowledgement of one's own or another's strengths, efforts, accomplishments, etc., can facilitate natural learning, whereas judgments interfere. What is the difference? Acknowledgement of and respect for one's capabilities support trust in self too. Self one's judgments, on the other hand, attempt to manipulate and undermine that trust. Chapter 4. Trusting Self Too. The thesis of the last chapter was that the first step in bringing a greater harmony between ego, mind, and body, that is, between self one and self two, was to let go of self-judgment. Only when self-one stops sitting in judgment over self-two and its actions can he become aware of who and what self-two is and appreciate the process by which it works. As this step occurs, trust is developed, and eventually the basic but elusive ingredient for all top performance emerges, self-confidence. Who and what is self-two? Put aside for a moment the opinions you have about your body, whether you think of it as clumsy, uncoordinated, average, or really fantastic, and think about what it does. As you read these very words, your body is performing a remarkable piece of coordination. Eyes are moving effortlessly, taking in images of black and white, which are automatically compared with memories of similar markings, translated into symbols, then connected with other symbols to form an impression of meaning. Thousands of these operations are taking place every few seconds. At the same time, again without conscious effort, your heart is pumping and your breath is going in and out, keeping a fantastically complicated system of organs, glands, and muscles nourished and working. Without conscious effort, billions of cells are functioning, reproducing, and fighting off disease. If you walked to a chair and turned on a light before beginning to read, your body coordinated a great number of muscle movements to accomplish those tasks. Self one did not have to tell your body how far to reach before closing your fingers on the light switch. You knew your goal, and your body did what was necessary without thought. The process by which the body learned and performed these actions is no different from the process by which it learns and plays the game of tennis. Reflect on the complicated series of actions performed by self-2 in the process of returning a serve. In order to anticipate how and where to move the feet, and whether to take the racket back on the forehand or backhand side, the brain must calculate within a fraction of a second the moment the ball leaves the server's racket, approximately where it is going to land, and where the racket will intercept it. Into this calculation must be computed the initial velocity of the ball, combined with an input for the progressive decrease in velocity and the effect of wind and of spin, to say nothing of the complicated trajectories involved. Then, each of these factors must be recalculated after the bounce of the ball to anticipate the point where contact will be made by the racket. Simultaneously, muscle orders must be given, not just once, but constantly refined on updated information. Finally, the muscles have to respond in cooperation with one another. A movement of feet occurs. The racket is taken back at a certain speed and height, and the face of the racket is kept at a constant angle as the racket and body move forward in balance. Contact is made at a precise point according to whether the order was given to hit down the line or cross court, an order not given until after a split-second analysis of the movement and balance of the opponent on the other side of the net. If Pete Sampras is serving, you have less than half a second to accomplish all this. Even if you are returning the serve of an average player, you will have only about 1 second. Just to hit the ball is clearly a remarkable feat. To return it with consistency and accuracy is a mind-boggling achievement, yet it is not uncommon. The truth is that everyone who inhabits a human body possesses a remarkable instrument. In the light of this, it seems inappropriate to call our bodies derogatory names. Self too, that is, the physical body, including the brain, memory bank, conscious and unconscious, and the nervous system, is a tremendously sophisticated and competent collection of potentialities. Inherent within it is an inner intelligence which is staggering. What it doesn't already know, this inner intelligence learns with childlike ease. It uses billions of cells and neurological communication circuits in every action. No computer yet made can come close to performing the complex physical actions accomplished by even a beginning tennis player, much less a professional. The foregoing has only one purpose, to encourage the reader to respect self too. This amazing instrument is what we have the effrontery to call uncoordinated. Reflect on the silent intelligence inherent in all self too actions, and our attitude of arrogance and mistrust will gradually change. With it, we'll dissolve the unnecessary self-instructions, criticisms, and tendencies to over-control that tend to occupy the unfocused mind. Trust thyself. As long as Self 1 is either too ignorant or too proud to acknowledge the capabilities of Self 2, true self-confidence will be hard to come by. It is Self 1's mistrust of Self 2 which causes both the interference called trying too hard and that of too much self-instruction. The first results in using too many muscles, the second in mental distraction and lack of concentration. Clearly, the new relationship to be established with ourselves must be based on the maxim, trust thyself. What does trust thyself mean on the tennis court? It doesn't mean positive thinking. For example, expecting that you are going to hit an ace on every serve. Trusting your body in tennis means letting your body hit the ball. The key word is let. You trust in the competence of your body and its brain, and you let it swing the racket. Self one stays out of it. But though this is very simple, it does not mean that it is easy. In some ways, the relationship between self one and self two is analogous to the relationship between parent and child. Some parents have a hard time letting their children do something when they believe that they themselves know better how it should be done. But the trusting and loving parent lets the child perform his own actions, even to the extent of making mistakes, because he trusts the child to learn from them. Letting it happen is not making it happen. It is not trying hard. It is not controlling your shots. These are all the actions of Self 1, which takes things into its own hands because it mistrusts Self 2. This is what produces tight muscles, rigid swings, awkward movements, gritted teeth, and tense cheek muscles. The results are mishit balls and a lot of frustration. Often when we are rallying, we trust our bodies and let it happen because the ego mind tells itself that it doesn't really count. But once the game begins, watch Self 1 take over. At the crucial point, it starts to doubt whether Self 2 will perform well. The more important the point, the more Self 1 may try to control the shot, and this is exactly when tightening up occurs. The results are almost always frustrating. Let's take a closer look at this tightening process, because it is a phenomenon which takes place in every athlete in every sport. Anatomy tells us that muscles are two-way mechanisms. That is, a given muscle is either relaxed or contracted. It can't be partially contracted any more than a light switch can be partially off. The difference between holding our racket loosely or tightly is in the number of muscles which are contracted. How many and which muscles are actually needed to hit a fast serve? No one knows, but if the conscious mind thinks it does and tries to control those muscles, it will inevitably use muscles that aren't needed. When more than necessary are used, not only is there a waste of energy, but certain tightened muscles interfere with the need of other muscles to relax. Thinking that it has to use a lot of muscle to hit as hard as it wants to, Self 1 will initiate the use of muscles in the shoulder, forearm, wrist, and even face, which will actually impede the force of the swing. If you have a racket handy, hold it and try this experiment. If you don't have a racket, grab any movable object or just grab the air with your hand. Tighten up the muscles in your wrist and see how fast you can snap your racket. Then, release the muscles in your wrist and see how fast it will snap. Clearly, a loose wrist is more flexible. When serving, power is generated, at least in part, by the flexible snap of the wrist. If you try to hit hard intentionally, you are likely to over-tighten the wrist muscles, slow down the snap of your wrist, and thereby lose power. Furthermore, the entire stroke will be rigid and balance will be difficult to maintain. This is how Self 1 interferes with the wisdom of the body. As you can imagine, a stiff-wristed serve will not meet the expectations of the server. Consequently, he is likely to try even harder next time, tightening more muscles and becoming more and more frustrated and exhausted, and, I might add, increasing the risk of tennis elbow. Fortunately, most children learn to walk before they can be told how to by their parents. Yet children not only learn how to walk very well, but they gain confidence in the natural learning process which operates within them. Mothers observe their children's efforts with love and interest, and if they are wise, without much interference. If we could treat our tennis games as we do a child learning to walk, we would make more progress. When the child loses his balance and falls, the mother doesn't condemn it for being clumsy. She doesn't even feel bad about it. She simply notices the event and perhaps gives a word or gesture of encouragement. Consequently, a child's progress in learning to walk is never hindered by the idea that he is uncoordinated. Why shouldn't a beginning player treat his backhand as a loving mother would her child? The trick is not to identify with the backhand. If you view an erratic backhand as a reflection of who you are, you will be upset. But you are not your backhand, any more than a parent is his child. If a mother identifies with every fall of her child and takes personal pride in its every success, her self-image will be as unstable as her child's balance. She finds stability when she realizes that she is not her child and watches it with love and interest, but as a separate being. The same kind of detached interest is what is necessary to let your tennis game develop naturally. Remember that you are not your tennis game. You are not your body. Trust the body to learn and to play, as you would trust another person to do a job, and in a short time, it will perform beyond your expectations. Let the flower grow. The preceding theory should be tested and not taken on faith. Toward the end of the chapter, there are several experiments that will give you a chance to experience the difference between making yourself do something and letting it happen. I suggest that you also devise your own experiments to discover just how much you are willing to trust yourself, both when rallying and when under pressure. Let it happen. At this point, it may have occurred to the reader to ask, how can I just let a forehand happen if I've never learned how to hit one in the first place? Don't I need someone to tell me how to do it? If I've never played tennis before, can I just go out on the court and let it happen? The answer is, if your body knows how to hit a forehand, then just let it happen. If it doesn't, then let it learn. The actions of self, too, are based on information it has stored in its memory of past actions of itself or of the observed actions of others. A player who has never held a racket in his hand needs to let the ball hit the strings a few times before self, too, learns how far away the center of the racket is from the hand holding it. Every time you hit a ball, whether correctly or incorrectly, the computer memory of self, too, is picking up valuable information and storing it away for future use. As one practices, Self 2 refines and extends the information in its memory bank. All the time, it is learning such things as how high a ball bounces when hit at varying speeds and varying spins, how fast a ball falls and how fast it comes up off the court, and where it should be met to direct it to different parts of the court. It remembers every action it makes and the results of every action, depending on the degree of your attention and alertness. So the important thing for a beginning player to remember is to allow the natural learning process to take place and to forget about stroke-by-stroke self-instructions. The results will be surprising. Let me illustrate with an example which demonstrates the easy and hard ways of learning. When I was 12 years old, I was sent to dancing school, where I was taught the waltz, foxtrot, and other steps known only to the darker ages of man. We were told, put your right foot here and your left foot there, then bring them together. Now shift your weight to your left foot, turn, and so forth. The steps were not complicated, but it was weeks before I was dancing without the need to play back the tape in my head. Put your left foot here, right foot there, turn, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. I would think out each step, command myself to do it, and then execute it. I was barely aware there was a girl in my arms, and it was weeks before I was able to handle a conversation while dancing. This is the way most of us teach ourselves the footwork and strokes of tennis, but it's such a slow and painful way. Contrast it with the way the modern 12-year-old learns to dance. He goes to a party one night, sees his friends doing whatever dances are in vogue at the time, and comes home having mastered them all. Yet these dances are infinitely more complex than the foxtrot. Just imagine the size of the instruction manual required to put into words each of the movements of these dances. It would require a PhD in physical education and a full semester to learn them by the book. But a kid who may be failing math and English learns them effortlessly in a single night. How does he do this? First, by simply watching. He doesn't think about what he is seeing. How the left shoulder lifts a bit while the head jerks forward and the right foot twists. He simply absorbs visually the image in front of him. This image completely bypasses the ego mind and seems to be fed directly to the body, for in a few minutes the kid is on the floor doing movements very similar to those he was watching. Now he is feeling how it is to imitate those images. He repeats the process a few times, first looking, then feeling, and soon is dancing effortlessly, totally with it. If the next day he is asked by his sister how to do the dance, he'll say, I don't know, like this. See? Ironically, he thinks he doesn't know how to do the dance because he can't explain it in words, while most of us who learn tennis through verbal instruction can explain in great detail how the ball should be hit, but have trouble doing it. To self, too, a picture is worth a thousand words. It learns by watching the actions of others, as well as by performing actions itself. Almost all tennis players have experienced playing over their heads after watching championship tennis on television. The benefits to your game come not from analyzing the strokes of top players, but from concentrating without thinking and simply letting yourself absorb the images before you. Then, the next time you play, you may find that certain important intangibles such as timing, anticipation, and sense of confidence are greatly improved, all without conscious effort or control. Communicating with self too. In short, for many of us, a new relationship needs to be forged with self too. And building new relationships involves new ways of communicating. If the former relationship was characterized by criticism and control, the symptoms of mistrust, then the more desired relationship is one of respect and trust. If so, this change can start with a change of attitude. If you observe self one in its critical posture, it looks down at self two and diminishes it in its own eyes with its disparaging thoughts. The other possibility is to learn to look up to self two. This is the attitude of respect based on true recognition of its natural intelligence and capabilities. Another word for this attitude is humility, a feeling that happens naturally in the presence of something or someone you admire. As you find your way to an attitude that slopes upward toward self too with respect, the feelings and thoughts that accompany the controlling and critical attitude fade, and the sincerity of self too emerges. With an attitude of respect, you learn to speak in the language of the respected person. The remainder of this chapter will discuss three basic methods of communicating with self too. It is basic to good communications that we use the most suitable language. If Mr. A wishes to make sure of getting his message across to Mr. B, he will, if he can, use Mr. B's native tongue. What is the native language of self too? Certainly not words. Words were not learned by self too until several years after birth. No, the native tongue of self too is imagery, sensory images. Movements are learned through visual and feeling images. So the three methods of communicating I will discuss all involve sending goal-oriented messages to self too by images and feelmages. Asking for results. Many students of tennis are too stroke conscious and not attentive enough to results. Such players are aware of how they stroke the ball, but unconcerned with where it is actually going. It is often helpful for these players to shift their attention from means to ends. Here is an example. During a group lesson with five women, I asked each player what one change she would most like to make in her game. The first woman, Sally, wanted to work on her forehand, which she said had been really terrible lately. When I asked her what she didn't like about her forehand, she replied, "Well, I take my racket back too late and too high, and I roll it over too much on the follow-through. Also, I take my eye off the ball a lot, and I don't think I step into it very well." It was clear that if I were to give her instruction on each element she mentioned, I would start and end the lesson with her. So I asked Sally what she felt about the results of her forehand, and she replied, "It goes too shallow and doesn't have much power." Now we had something we could work with. I told her that I imagined her body, self too, already knew how to hit the ball deep and with more power, and that if it didn't, it would learn very quickly. I suggested that she imagine the arc the ball would have to take to land deep in the court, noticing how high over the net it would pass, and hold that image in her mind for several seconds. Then, before hitting some balls, I said, "Don't try to hit the ball deep. Just ask self too to do it and let it happen. If the ball continues to fall shallow, don't make any conscious effort to correct. Simply let go and see what happens." The third ball Sally hit landed a foot inside the baseline. Of the next 20, 15 landed in the back quarter of the court, and did so with increasing force behind them. As she hit, the other four women and I could see all the elements she had mentioned changing appreciably and naturally. Her backswing lowered, her follow-through flattened, and she began flowing into the ball with balance and confidence. When she was finished hitting, I asked her what changes she had made, and she replied, "I didn't make any. I just imagined the ball passing 2 feet over the net and landing near the baseline, and it did." She was both delighted and surprised. The changes that Sally made in her forehand lay in the fact that she gave self too a clear visual image of the results she desired. Then she told her body, in effect, "Do whatever you have to do to go there." All she had to do was let it happen. Getting the clearest possible image of your desired outcomes is a most useful method for communicating with self too, especially when playing a match. Once you are competing, it is too late to work on your strokes, but it is possible to hold in your mind the image of where you want the ball to go, and then allow the body to do what is necessary to hit it there. It is essential here to trust self too. Self one must stay relaxed, refraining from giving how-to-do-it instructions and from any effort to control the stroke. As self one learns to let go, a growing confidence in the ability of self two emerges. Asking for form. It is sometimes useful to be able to make a deliberate change in one or more elements of a given stroke. This process will be discussed in greater detail in Chapter 6, Changing Habits. In brief, the process is very similar to asking for results. Suppose, for example, that you are consistently rolling your racket over on the follow-through, and the habit continues despite all efforts to change it. First, you must give self two a very clear image of what you are asking it to do. This can best be done by holding your racket in front of you in a proper follow-through position and looking at it with undivided attention for several seconds. You may feel foolish, thinking that you already know the proper follow-through, but it is vital to give self two an image to imitate. Having done this, it might also be useful to shut your eyes and imagine as clearly as possible your entire forehand with the racket staying flat throughout the swing. Then, before hitting any balls, swing your racket several times, letting the racket stay flat and allowing yourself to experience how it feels to swing in this new way. Once you start to hit balls, it is important not to try and keep your racket flat. You have asked self two to keep it flat, so let it happen. Self one's only role is to be still and observe the results in a detached manner. Let me stress again that it is important not to make any conscious effort to keep the racket flat. If after a few strokes the racket does not conform to the image you gave self two, then imagine the desired outcome again and let your body swing your racket, making sure self two isn't giving it the slightest assistance. Don't try to make this experiment work. If you do, self one will get involved and you won't really know if self two is hitting the ball unassisted or not. Two experiments. It is important not only to understand intellectually the difference between letting it happen and making it happen, but to experience the difference. To experience the difference is to know the difference. To this end, let me suggest two experiments. The first involves trying to hit a stationary target with a tennis ball. Place a tennis ball can in the backhand corner of one of the service courts. Then, figure out how you should swing your racket in order to hit the can. Think about how high to toss the ball, about the proper angle of your racket at impact, the proper weight flow, and so forth. Now aim at the can and attempt to hit it. If you miss, try again. If you hit it, try to repeat whatever you did so that you can hit it again. If you follow this procedure for a few minutes, you will experience what I mean by trying hard and making yourself serve. After you have absorbed this experience, move the can to the backhand corner of the other service court for the second half of the experiment. This time, stand on the baseline, breathe deeply a few times, and relax. Look at the can. Then, visualize the path of the ball from your racket to the can. See the ball hitting the can right on the label. If you like, shut your eyes and imagine yourself serving and the ball hitting the can. Do this several times. If in your imagination the ball misses the can, that's all right. Repeat the image a few times until the ball hits the target. Now, take no thought of how you should hit the ball. Don't try to hit the target. Ask your body, self two, to do whatever is necessary to hit the can, then let it do it. Exercise no control. Correct for no imagined bad habits. Simply trust your body to do it. When you toss the ball up, focus your attention on its seams. Then let the serve serve itself. The ball will either hit or miss the target. Notice exactly where it lands. You should free yourself from any emotional reaction to success or failure. Simply know your goal and take objective interest in the results. Then serve again. If you have missed the can, don't be surprised and don't try to correct for your error. This is most important. Again, focus your attention on the can. Then let the serve serve itself. If you faithfully do not try to hit the can, and do not attempt to correct for your misses, but put full confidence in your body and its computer, you will soon see that the serve is correcting itself. You will experience that there really is a self, too, who is acting and learning without being told what to do. Observe this process. Observe your body making the changes necessary in order to come nearer and nearer to the can. Of course, self one is very tricky, and it is most difficult to keep it from interfering a little. But if you quiet it a bit, you will begin to see self two at work, and you will be as amazed as I have been at what it can do and how effortlessly. The second experiment I would recommend in order to experience the reality of self two begins with picking some change you would like to make in one of your strokes. For instance, choose a bad habit that you have been trying unsuccessfully to alter. Then, on the court, ask a friend to throw you 20 balls and try to correct the habit. Tell him what you were trying to do, and ask him to observe if it is correcting. Try hard. Try the way you are used to in attempting to change a habit. Experience this kind of trying. Observe how you feel if you fail. Also note whether you feel awkward or tight. Now, try to practice your corrected stroke while rallying. Then, see what happens when you play a match. Next, pick another habit you would like to change, or even the same one. If the habit has not been corrected by your first efforts, it would be interesting to work on the same one. Ask your friend to throw you 5 or 10 balls. During this, make no attempt to change your stroke. Simply observe it. Don't analyze it. Just observe it carefully. Experience where your racket is at all times. Changes may occur while you are merely observing your stroke non-judgmentally. But if you feel further correction is needed, then create an image of the desired form. Show yourself exactly what you want self two to do. Give it a clear visual image, moving your racket slowly in the desired path, and let yourself watch it very closely. Then repeat the process, but this time feel exactly what it's like to move your racket in this new manner. Having provided yourself with an image and a feeling, you are ready to hit some balls. Now focus your eyes and mind on the seams of the ball and let it happen. Then observe what happened. Once again, don't analyze. Simply see how close self two came to doing what you wanted it to. If your racket didn't follow the path you had imagined, then recreate the image and let the stroke happen again. Continue this process, letting self one relax more and more with each ball. Soon you will see that self two can be trusted. Long-standing habits can be altered in a few moments. After 20 balls or so, ask your friend to rally again with you. Be sure you don't try to make this experiment work by attempting to do it right when playing. Merely continue to observe the precise part of your swing that is changing. Watch it with detachment and care, as you would watch someone else's stroke. Watch it, and it will change quite effortlessly by its own smooth process. Perhaps this seems too good to be true. I can only suggest that you experiment and see for yourself. More needs to be said about this art of changing habits, because it is what so many players spend so much time and money on in lessons. But before undertaking a fuller description of this art, let's discuss a third method of communicating with self too. Asking for qualities. In the last chapter, I pointed out how the process of judgment often feeds on and extends itself until a strong negative self-image has formed. One begins believing that he is not a good tennis player, and then acts this role, never allowing himself anything but glimpses of his true capabilities. Most players hypnotize themselves into acting the roles of much worse players than they actually are, but interesting results can often be achieved by doing a little role-playing of a different kind. Asking for qualities describes this other kind of role-playing. When introducing this idea, I usually say something like this. Imagine that I am the director of a television series. Knowing that you are an actor that plays tennis, I ask if you would like to do a bit part as a top-flight tennis player. I assure you that you needn't worry about hitting the ball out or into the net, because the camera will only be focused on you and will not follow the ball. What I'm mainly interested in is that you adopt professional mannerisms, and that you swing your racket with supreme self-assurance. Above all, your face must express no self-doubt. You should look as if you are hitting every ball exactly where you want to. Really get into the role, hit as hard as you like, and ignore where the ball is actually going. When a player succeeds in forgetting himself and really acts out his assumed role, remarkable changes in his game often take place. If you don't mind puns, you might even say that the changes are dramatic. As long as he is able to stay in this role, he experiences qualities that he may not have known were in his repertoire. There is an important distinction between this kind of role-playing and what is normally called positive thinking. In the latter, you are telling yourself that you are as good as Steffi Graf or Michael Chang, while in the former, you are not trying to convince yourself that you are any better than you believe you are. You are quite consciously playing a role, but in the process, you may become more aware of the range of your true capabilities. After they have played tennis for a year or so, most people fall into a particular pattern of play from which they seldom depart. Some adopt a defensive style. They spare no effort to retrieve every ball, lob often, hit deep into the opponent's court, and seldom hit the ball hard or go for a winner. The defensive player waits for his opponent to make an error and wears him down by degrees with endless patience. Some Italian clay court players used to be the prototype for this style. The opposite of this is the offensive style. In its extreme form, the ball is hit for a winner every time. Every serve is designed to be an ace, every return of serve a clean passing shot, while volleys and overheads are all aimed to land within 1 or 2 inches of the lines. A third common pattern is what might be called the formal style of play. Players in this category don't care so much where their ball goes as long as they look good stroking it. They would rather be seen using flawless form than winning the match. In contrast, there is the competitive style of the player who will do anything to win. He runs hard and hits hard or soft, depending on what seems to bother his opponent most, exploiting his every weakness, mental and physical. Having outlined these basic styles to a group of players, I often suggest that as an experiment, they adopt the style that seems most unlike the one they have previously adopted. I also suggest that they act the role of a good player, no matter what style they have chosen. Besides being a lot of fun, this kind of role-playing can greatly increase a player's range. The defensive player learns that he can hit winners. The aggressive one finds that he can also be stylish. I have found that when players break their habitual patterns, they can greatly extend the limits of their own style and explore subdued aspects of their personality. As you gain easier access to the variety of qualities encompassed in your self too, you begin to realize that you can call upon any of these qualities as appropriate to the given situation on or off the tennis court. Letting go of judgments, the art of creating images, and letting it happen are three of the basic skills involved in the inner game. Before going on to the fourth and most important inner skill, that of concentration, I will devote one chapter to a discussion of external technique and how to master any technique without resorting to the kind of judgmental thinking and over-control that we have seen undermine self-2's natural abilities. Chapter 5. Discovering Technique. The preceding chapters placed heavy emphasis on the importance of quieting the thinking mind by letting go of mental self-instructions, focusing attention, and trusting the body to do what it is capable of doing. The purpose of these chapters was to lay the foundation for learning technique in a more natural and effective way. Before introducing specific techniques of the various tennis strokes, I would like to make some general comments on the relationship between technical instructions and the self-too learning process. To me, it makes sense to build any system of instruction upon the best possible understanding of natural learning, the learning process you were born with. The less instruction interferes with the process of learning built into your very DNA, the more effective your progress is going to be. Said another way, the less fear and doubt are embedded in the instructional process, the easier it will be to take the natural steps of learning. One way to gain insight and trust in natural learning is to observe young children learning before they have been taught, or to observe animals in the act of teaching their young. Once, when I was walking through the San Diego Zoo, I had the chance to observe a mother hippopotamus giving her baby what looked to be its first swimming lesson. At the deep end of the pool, one hippo was floating with just its nose above the surface. Soon it submerged and sank to the bottom, where it seemed to rest for about 20 seconds before pushing off with its hind legs and rising again to the surface. Then I watched a mother hippo, which had been nursing her baby in the sun, get up and begin to push it toward the pond with her snout. When the baby toppled in, it sank like a rock to the bottom and stayed there. Mother sauntered casually to the shallow end of the pool and waded in. About 20 seconds later, she reached the baby and began to lift it upward with her nose, sending it toward the surface. There, the young student gasped a breath and sank again. Once again, the mother repeated the process, but this time moved off to the deeper end of the pool, somehow knowing that her role in the learning process was finished. The baby hippo inhaled on the surface and sank again to the bottom, but after some time, it pushed itself toward the surface with its own hind legs. Then, the new skill was repeated again and again. It seemed that the mother knew exactly how much it needed to show, when to encourage, and when encouragement was no longer needed. It knew it could trust a great deal in the instinct of the child once it was jump-started. Though I would not go so far as to say a topspin backhand is already imprinted within your genetic structure, I would say that the natural learning process is so encoded, and that we would do well to acknowledge and respect it. As either teacher or student, we will be most ourselves and most effective only to the extent that we can be in harmony with it. Where do technical instructions originate? Tennis was brought to America from Europe in the late 1800s. There were no professional tennis teachers to teach technique. The best were players who experienced certain feelings in their swings and tried to communicate those feelings to others. In the effort to understand how to use technical knowledge or theory, I believe that it is most important to recognize that, fundamentally, experience precedes technical knowledge. We may read books or articles that present technical instructions before we have ever lifted a racket, but where did these instructions come from? At some point, did they not originate in someone's experience? Either by accident or by intention, someone hit a ball in a certain way and it felt good and it worked. Through experimentation, refinements were made and finally settled into a repeatable stroke. Perhaps in the interest of being able to repeat that way of hitting the ball again or to pass it on to another, the person attempts to describe that stroke in language. But words can only represent actions, ideas, and experiences. Language is not the action, and at best can only hint at the subtlety and complexity contained in the stroke. Although the instruction thus conceived can now be stored in the part of the mind that remembers language, it must be acknowledged that remembering the instruction is not the same as remembering the stroke itself. Of course, it is very convenient to think that by giving ourselves correct instruction, hit from low to high, for example, we will hit great topspin backhands again and again. We want to trust self-one's conceptual process of learning technique, instead of self-two's learning from experience. Thinking that it was the obeying of an instruction that produced the good shot, ignoring the role that self-two plays, sets us up for disappointment when we give the same instruction yet the same good shot does not occur. Since we think the instruction was correct, the conclusion we come to is that not obeying it led to the error. Then we may get angry at ourselves, make disparaging remarks about our ability, and call ourselves stupid or use a variety of ways to blame ourselves. But maybe the error was in not trusting self-two enough and relying too much on self-one control. It is as if we would like to think of ourselves more as an obedient computer than as a human being. As a consequence, we are apt to lose access to the direct pathway to the muscle memory that carries a more complete knowledge of the desired action. In a society that has become so oriented toward language as a way of representing truth, it is very possible to lose touch with your ability to feel, and with it, your ability to remember the shots themselves. I believe this remembering is a fundamental act of trust in self too, without which excellence in any skill cannot be sustained. When the verbal instruction is passed on to another person who does not have in his bank of experience the action being described in memory, it lives in the mind totally disconnected from experience. The chances are now even greater that there will be a split between memory of theory and the memory of action. I am reminded of the lines from The Hollow Men by T.S. Eliot. Between the idea and the reality, between the motion and the act, falls the shadow. And as we begin to use an instruction to pass judgment on our shots, instead of attending to the lessons of experience, the gap between experience and instruction is further widened. The instruction, used as a conceptual should or should not, puts a shadow of fear between self-2's intuitive knowing and the action. Many times I have seen students hitting perfectly good shots, but complaining about them because they thought they did something wrong. By the time they have brought their stroke into conformity with their concept of the right way to do it, the shot has lost both power and consistency, as well as naturalness. In short, if we let ourselves lose touch with our ability to feel our actions by relying too heavily on instructions, we can seriously compromise our access to our natural learning processes and our potential to perform. Instead, if we hit the ball, relying on the instincts of self-2, we reinforce the simplest neural pathway to the optimal shot. Though this discussion has been primarily theoretical up to this point, it has recently been confirmed by the United States Tennis Association Sports Science Department, as well as by almost everyone's experience, that too many verbal instructions, given either from outside or inside, interfere with one's shot-making ability. It is also common experience that one verbal instruction given to 10 different people will take on 10 different meanings. Trying too hard to perform even a single instruction not well understood can introduce an awkwardness or rigidity into the swing that inhibits excellence. In previous chapters, I made the point that a great deal of technique can be learned naturally by simply paying close attention to one's body, racket, and ball while playing. The more awareness one can bring to bear on any action, the more feedback one gets from experience, and the more naturally one learns the technique that feels best and works best for any given player at any given state of development. Bottom line, there is no substitute for learning from experience. However, even though we have the ability to learn naturally, many of us have forgotten, and many of us have lost touch with feel. We may need to learn how to feel again and learn how to learn again. The saying of an old master is pertinent here. No teacher is greater than one's own experience. How to make best use of technical instructions. So the question that remains is how one person's greater level of experience can help another person. The short answer is that a valid instruction derived from experience can help me if it guides me to my own experiential discovery of any given stroke possibility. From the point of view of the student, the question becomes how to listen to technical instructions and use them without falling into the self-won traps of judgment, doubt, and fear. For the teacher or coach, the question has to be how to give instructions in such a way as to help the natural learning process of the student and not interfere with it. If insight can be gained into these questions, I believe they would be applicable to the learning of skills in many different domains. Let's begin with a very simple yet common instruction given by many teaching professionals. Keep the wrist firm when hitting the backhand. I would guess that this instruction originated from someone's accurate observations of the relative consistency and power of backhands hit when the wrist was firm compared to when it was loose or wobbly. As obvious as this instruction might sound at first, let's analyze it before casting it into the bronze of dogma. Can the backhand be hit with a wrist that is too loose to give control? Certainly. But can it also be hit with a wrist that is too firm? Yes, of course it can. So as helpful as this instruction might appear, you cannot use it successfully by merely obeying it. Instead, you use the instruction to guide your discovery of the optimal degree of tightness of your wrist. This, of course, can be done by paying attention to the feel of your wrist during your stroke and does not necessarily have to be put into language. You will hit some shots with too loose a wrist, others perhaps with too tight a wrist, and automatically you will find what is comfortable and works best for you and settle with that. Obviously, the exact degree of tightness you discovered worked for you would be very hard to put into definitive language. It is remembered by its feel. This is a very different process from obeying the instruction. If I believe dogmatically in the firm wrist instruction, and if in fact my wrist has been too loose, my first shots with a firmer wrist will probably seem better to me. Then I might say to myself, firming my wrist is good. So on subsequent shots, I remember to tell myself to firm my wrist. But on these shots, my wrist was already firm, so now it is too tight. Soon the tightness is spreading all the way up my arm, to my neck, my cheeks, and my lips. But I am obeying my instruction, so what went wrong? Soon, somebody has to tell me to relax. But how do I relax the right amount? I go back in the other direction until I am too wobbly again. So, I believe the best use of technical knowledge is to communicate a hint toward a desired destination. The hint can be delivered verbally or demonstrated in action, but it is best seen as an approximation of a desirable goal to be discovered by paying attention to each stroke and feeling one's way toward what works for that individual. If I want to give the instruction, hit from low to high to produce topspin, to avoid self-won over control, I might first demonstrate with the student's racket and arm approximately what those words mean. Then I might say, but don't try to do it. Just notice if your racket is coming from high to low, is coming through level with the ball, or coming from low to high. After a few shots are hit from low to high, I might ask for more subtle awareness of the degree of low to high of successive shots. In this way, the student experiences the relationship between the degree of low to high and the amount of topspin achieved, and is able to explore a range of possibilities and discover what feels best and works for himself, without the constraint of thinking there is a specifically right way to do it to which he must conform. If you asked a group of teaching professionals to write down all the important elements of hitting a forehand, most would find it easy to distinguish at least 50, and they might have several categories for each element. Imagine the difficulty for the tennis player dealing with this complexity. No wonder self-doubt is so easy to come by. On the other hand, understanding the swing and remembering its feel is like remembering a single picture. The mind is capable of that, and can recognize when one element in one picture is slightly different from another. The other advantage of using awareness to discover the technique is that it doesn't tend to evoke the over-controlling and judgmental aspects of self-won, which wants to rely on formula rather than feel. The remainder of this chapter will offer a few technical instructions that you can use to help you discover effective technique for each of the major strokes in tennis. The effort is not to give all the instructions that you might eventually need, but to give enough of a sample that you can better understand how to use any technical instructions from any source as a means towards your discovery of your optimal stroke production. Before beginning, let me simplify the external requirements of tennis. The player has only two requirements for success: hit each ball over the net and into the court. The sole aim of stroke technique is to fulfill these two requirements with consistency and enough pace and accuracy to provide maximum difficulty for one's opponent. Keeping it simple, let's look at a few of the dynamics for hitting forehand and backhand ground strokes over the net and into the court. One thing we will see is that the officially approved techniques for doing this have changed considerably over the years. That which was dogmatically true is no longer so true. Ground strokes. Grips. If you were to ask 10 tennis players why they hold their racket with one grip when hitting the forehand and a different grip when hitting the backhand, most would probably answer that they read it in a book or magazine or were taught it by their pro. Even though what they were told might be correct, if they have little experiential understanding of grips or why you change them, it is unlikely that they will really discover the best grips for their game. A great deal of information about grips is readily available. One reason players have learned to change grips is to provide the strongest bond between racket and hand on each shot. But because every hand is slightly different, the exact positioning of your grip should be adjusted according to what is comfortable for your hand, while allowing the desired support and racket angle. The same goes for how tightly you should grip the racket. Just try to describe this in language.